Thank you. Thank you very much indeed. I don't know why I bother to stand up. I'm always told it seems to make absolutely no difference whether I speak from sitting down or standing up. I'm very happy to be here in my current work with the International Crisis Group. I'm actually posted in Brussels. As an aside, you will notice I haven't had a great manager of my international career. I've hit Geneva, The Hague, Ottawa, and Brussels. What's wrong with New York, Paris, Tokyo? I seem to have had all these interchangeable venues. I'm not too sure why I was so keen to come to participate in this event, except in a totally self-gratifying way. I work in conflict resolution. This really doesn't have much to do with what I do on a daily basis, but I thought I had to treat myself to see what's happening on these kinds of issues in the future in Canada. And Patrick was the first one to say it, and now David, again, very forcefully. I'm sort of down memory lane with this kind of romanticism about all the past efforts, so I'm still waiting to hear where this is all going, and I'm not sure I have much to contribute to that. Let me give you just a little bit of context. Yesterday, I went to the passport office on Victoria Street, unsuccessfully, I might mention, in light of the length of the lineup. But as I joined the lineup, I saw a sign, and it said, for bilingual services, go to North York at Young and Shepherd. I thought, now wait a minute, I leave for 2 years and we regress 30? What is this, go to North York for bilingual services, for a pretty kind of central federal government service? It reminded me of something that had happened to me when I first moved to Toronto in the early 70s, and you'll see there's a point to this. I had gone, I think, to renew my driver's license. So it was a provincial service, and I had to pay a fee. So I wrote a check, and I wrote the number in French. And I gave the check, and this person said, what does it say? I said, it says in letters the same thing it says in number, whatever, $28. She said, well, you can't write that in French. I said, well, actually, a check is governed by the Bills of Exchange Act, which is a federal statute, which is itself governed by the Official Languages Act, so you have to take it. Now, the point of it is, first of all, this was absolutely mishmash legal analysis. It had nothing to do with whether the Official Languages Act applied and whether she had to take it. But it's at a time where I believe that law mattered and that everything could be resolved with a sober legal answer. Well, I've come a very long way. I've believed that for long enough to serve in the Canadian judiciary at every level. I still believed then. I do believe now, but to a considerably lesser extent, that law mattered. I've now been drawn through various international endeavors more into the interface between law and politics, which is what interests me in the conversation we're having here today. And I'm a little bit worried that once again, it's been slightly hijacked by the legal discourse. And I'll say a few more about constitutionalism and whether this will actually give, quote, an answer to the, quote, Quebec question. I don't think it's a question in the sense that it calls for an answer, and I'll get there. So the other thing I should say is I found the atmosphere, certainly this morning, a little more, pick the right word, not adversarial, a little more tense, maybe, than I had expected. So I will point to at least something that all the various participants so far have in common, which is they cannot respect time limits. I had been told I had 5 minutes. I assume they've been told the same thing, unless they were profound inequities that let politicians speak for 30 minutes and the rest of us for five. But anyway, they were. So this is maybe part of our Canadian, common Canadian identity, is we have no respect for time limits. I'm going to try to be very brief. I'd like to talk about a few themes that I see. The work I do now, I run an NGO whose mission is the prevention of armed conflict. The prevention, we're not all that successful, as you can see, so most of the work we do is, in fact, the mitigation, and on a lucky day, the resolution of armed conflict. So, and we're not a thematic organization, we're a purely geographic organization. So I will try to extract some themes that I think are very relevant to where Quebec and Canada are situated in the international discourse on nationalism, secession movements, institution building, and to some extent, constitutionalism. When I left Canada, really, first I left Quebec and then I left Canada to work internationally, maybe the biggest cultural shock to me was to discover that nationalism was a very dirty word outside this environment. It had never been for me growing up and being educated in Montreal. In fact, it was a very noble expression, and it was the stuff of poets and chansonniers. It was more cultural early on than political, and it certainly, the one I experienced, was not about the politics of exclusion. It was the politics of empowerment, the same way that feminism was the politics of empowerment, not of exclusion. And then I was parachuted in the former Yugoslavia, at the heart of the pathologies, the most vicious, profound pathologies of nationalism. And I have yet really to rediscover nationalism on the international scene that is not viewed with profound suspicion and, frankly, a lot of contempt by otherwise Democrats, including people very committed to fundamental human rights values. For instance, it's immediately associated currently in Europe with the rise of the far right. The minute you mention nationalism, it's the immediate response that you get. So it takes a long time to bring it back to its Canadian, or at least its Quebec connotation. I think Quebec is at a kind of crossroads of two different kinds of nationalism. One that I would call the nationalism of self-described oppressed minorities, and at the same time, the nationalism of threatened majorities. That's the one that gives rise to far-right movements in Europe. I can assure you that when the Arab Spring started, before it was even called a spring, in Tunisia and in Egypt, and even before Libya, the very first response in Europe, loud and clear, was, oh my God, the barbarians are at the gate. It was an immigration response before it turned into something much more noble and concerned and so on. It was a Europe problem. It was not a North Africa and Middle East awakening. So, and this is the nationalism of what I call a threatened majority of national states. You see it in Nordic countries. You see it in many European countries. I think Quebec actually has the paradox of being both, if candidly describing itself. It's a nationalism rooted in a history of being a perceived oppressed minority, and the level of oppression, I mean, is very debatable when you consider the fate of other minorities in other countries, but also being a threatened majority, I think, in its own sphere of existence. Canada also has another feature that's very striking when you compare to various movements in Europe, which is that many, certainly European countries, increasingly African countries, cannot self-define. They are profoundly defined by their neighbors. They've been at war. Europe, in fact, its greatest success is the pacification of Europe and the birth of the European Union. Canada's never been defined by its neighbors, including, well, I suppose, except the big one. But it has, I think, encouraged a huge amount of navel-gazing because it has been entirely defined internally as opposed through the mirror and the interaction with very immediate neighbors. Let me say a few things about secession movements. When I first looked at the program here, I saw that the only reference to a potential comparable or model or question that would be of interest was the Scottish model, which, I mean, one could say is a tad ethnocentric. I mean, there's been a lot of successful and unsuccessful secession movements in recent history about which we could learn something. Now, I hear you. You're going to say, this is not South Sudan. I grant you that. But in South Sudan, for instance, the question of dual citizenship is a question that could have some sort of interesting applications. And you might say, this is not Kosovo. Now, that's true. But if you look at the north of Kosovo, where there's a little enclave of 30,000 Serbs who don't want to be part of Kosovo and say, wait a minute, who decided we were in Serbia, now you say we're in Kosovo, could we just redraw that border a bit? So partition of the north of Kosovo raises a lot of questions about the interface of the principles of self-determination and of territorial integrity. All kinds of secession issues that are, I think, somewhat interesting. Most self-determination / secessionist claims in Europe are now frozen. We could go from Cyprus to South Ossetia and Abkhazia in relation to Georgia. I mean, there's a whole range of issues that are completely frozen and seem absolutely intractable, except to the extent that they could be resolved by force, by a resumption of war. When that does not happen, and why this is never put on the table in Canada as even remotely an option, I think, is because of the quality of institutions. The World Bank report, the World Bank Development Report for 2011, examined questions of security and development, and loud and clear, the greatest investment, I think, in peaceful conflict resolution is the quality of institutions. So on this one, all within my 5 minutes, I just want to say something about the Supreme Court of Canada. And the reason I want I think it's an interesting thing to look at in the Canadian context, is that I think it says something about how constitutional change and so on is not key. You can have profound cultural changes within, as Patrick, I think, mentioned, you have all kinds of evolution, cultural, political evolution, within a framework that may seem completely frozen in time. The profile, the jurisprudence, the work of the Supreme Court of Canada has been revolutionary, in part, I concede, by the increased powers conferred on the court in 1982 by the Charter, no question. But even aside that, the composition of the court